TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The New Pearl Harbor. The historian Howard Zinn said, "David Ray Griffin has done admirable and painstaking research in reviewing the mysteries surrounding the 9/11 attacks. It is the most persuasive argument I have seen for further investigation of the Bush administration's relationship to that historic and troubling event." End of quote. If the events of 9/11 had occurred the way the Bush administration says they did, it would have been the first time in history that an event that led up to war occurred without manipulation. From the sinking of the Maine in the harbor of Havana to the fabricated attacks on American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, and, according to historian Gore Vidal, Pearl Harbor itself, these events are remembered as manufactured news. Why would 9/11 be different? David Ray Griffin lists 40 incidents that raise serious doubts about the official version, and he covers some of them in the interview you are about to hear. David Ray Griffin has been a professor of philosophy of religion at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California for over 30 years. We began by talking about the interim report of the 9/11 Commission and Griffin's comments on Fahrenheit 9/11. Let's start with the official 9/11 Commission. When I began the TUC radio series on 9/11 about 10 weeks ago, I referred to the many unanswered questions that need to be addressed. Meanwhile, the official 9/11 investigation left us with a huge number of unquestioned answers. Would you like to comment on the official investigation as it stands now at the end of June 2004?
Well, a lot of people had referred to the so-called 9/11 Independent Commission as the 9/11 Cover-Up Commission. I mentioned that label in my book, but I did not endorse it. But I'm afraid now that the weeks have gone by and the public hearings have ended, that it does look like that indeed is the case, because they simply refused to ask any of the really disturbing questions. And like you say, they refused to question any of the answers they had begun with. For example, when the NORAD officials say that they didn't expect this kind of attack from inside, and that all of their radar was really pointed outward as if the Cold War were still going on, first of all, that seems just very implausible, given their own statements on their websites as to how sophisticated their equipment is, and how, for example, they say that the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon says that their equipment is so sophisticated that it could monitor many, many missiles coming from, you know, submarine-launched missiles simultaneously. And that if they could do that, they could not monitor three or four airliners because they were looking outward is just implausible. And furthermore, that would be easy to check, but they've done no checking. They've done no serious subpoenaing. As far as we can tell, there's been no serious questioning of the word of government officials.
There's one more thing that happened since your book appeared earlier this year in 2004. and that's the release of Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11. Do you have any comments on that movie?
Well, I think like at least many people who have seen it, I think it's mixed. On the one hand, for people who haven't been following the issues very closely, I think it's a real eye-opener. Moore gets to several very important facts that have been not widely publicized by the mainline media. And so I think his movie will have quite an impact. And even though, for the most part, he seems simply to assume the orthodox theory about the attacks, that is, that they were carried out by 19 Arab Muslim hijackers, I think his movie will create a general air of skepticism about 9/11, and therefore open up people to pursuing the issue further, and so therefore perhaps being willing to read books such as mine that summarize the arguments against the official account. Some people have asked me about smoking guns, and I hadn't used that terminology, but then because that question has been raised so much, I went back and went through the book and said, now what do I think at least are prima facie smoking guns, things that on the surface of it appear to be very incriminating facts that if they were really explored would lead to the conclusion there was government complicity. And I was rather surprised that I came up with so many, that I came up with a list of 40. So Moore's movie, I would say, may have dealt with three or four of those at the most. So certainly I would have a lot. Let me give one example. Many people have thought the most effective part of his movie was simply his playing the video of President Bush in the classroom, listening to the students read about their pet goat for about 7 minutes after he learned that the second tower had been hit. Now, that's significant because after the official story is that he didn't learn about the first tower being hit until he got to the school at 9 o'clock and passed that off as a horrible accident. So no indication that he believed that it was part of some larger terrorist attack. But clearly when Andrew Card came in and told him about the second one, then there could be no doubt in anybody's mind that America was under attack, again, if we're accepting the official story. And yet, he sat there, and Michael Moore did mention in the movie that that the Secret Service did not hustle him off. But I would have made much more of that because I think that's the most significant thing there. You'll remember that later in the day, after they went to Air Force One and took off, then the president stayed away from Washington for many hours. And he was widely criticized because some people said, well, he seems to be afraid. But the crucial issue was that for that first hour while they were at the school, there seemed to be no fear whatsoever. We're told that Vice President Cheney, when they thought the White House was in danger, was lifted up bodily by two Secret Service guys who hustled him downstairs to the underground bunker. And yet, surely the President of the United States, if this were a genuine terrorist attack, would be the number one target. And everybody in the country who was paying attention knew where he was because he was scheduled to give a TV broadcast at about 9:30 that morning. And yet the Secret Service just allowed him to stay there in plain sight with no military planes flying over, no protection whatsoever. Now, when Bush was asked about this, he said, well, I wanted to project calm so I wouldn't frighten the children. But wouldn't the most important thing being, get out of there to protect the children, because if terrorists had struck, probably all 200 people at the school would have been killed. So the story is very implausible and suggests that the Secret Service, whoever was the head of the Secret Service, knew that they were not targets.
Would you present us with just one more of your 40 smoking gun incidents?
Well, one certainly is parents' stand down, the failure to have normal operating procedures in effect on 9/11. Another would be the whole story about the Pentagon, all the evidence that suggests, rather than it being Flight 77 that hit it, which was a Boeing 757, that it was some much smaller aircraft and indeed a military aircraft. And yet another would be the collapse of all three buildings of the World Trade Center, not only the Twin Towers that everybody knows about, but also Building 7, which in some respects is more significant yet. So we could talk about any of those.
Okay, why don't we talk about the failure to intercept? Because the reaction to my particular radio series has been the strongest on that one example. And I was really impressed by the way you present this particular incident in your book, because you say, quote, "In light of standard procedures for dealing with hijacked airplanes, however, not one of these planes should have reached its target, let alone all three of them." Can you pick it up from there?
Well, yes. Let's take the first flight, Flight 11, because in some respects that's the toughest case, because one might argue, well, they were surprised by this. So let's look at the figures and standard operating procedure. Standard procedure is if there is any sign that a plane is possibly hijacked, that it goes radically off course, they lose radio contact, or the transponders are turned off, the FAA ground controller is supposed to notify NORAD and the National Military Command Center. That's really simultaneous notification, immediately, and that usually happens within a minute. And then NORAD is assigned the task of deciding what is the closest military base and ordering two jet fighters to be scrambled, that is, sent up to intercept. And that normally takes another minute to give that order. And then, according to NORAD itself, these jets, particularly the F-15s, can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes. And then they travel at 1,850 miles an hour. So they can intercept planes very quickly, and normally within 10 to 15 minutes anywhere in the United States. And yet that morning, they knew at 8:14 that this flight was possibly hijacked, and it was not until 8:46 that it hit the North Tower. In other words, 32 minutes passed, and no plane was even within sight of it. And in fact, according to NORAD, and here it gets more complex because we have to say according to the second version of NORAD's story, the scramble order wasn't given until 2 minutes before 8:46, and so the jets didn't really have a chance. So that's certainly one of the questions that should have been pressed much more at the 9/11 Commission than it was. They just accepted the idea that there was somehow mass confusion and mass incompetence. And now the military, NORAD, is saying if the FAA had told us in time, sure, we could have intercepted. And the FAA is saying, we believe we told them in time. And so somebody clearly is not telling the truth there, and yet there was no real pressure to find out who it was, if anyone was telling the truth. And if the FAA controllers had waited until 8:40, as NORAD claims, that would have been 26 minutes. This would have been gross incompetence, even criminal negligence. These people should have been prosecuted. They certainly should have been fired, but nobody was even publicly reprimanded. So it's hard to believe the incompetence theory.
In all these delays, the most inexplicable one is not to have scrambled for the flight that supposedly approached the Pentagon.
That's right. Just to mention Flight 175 very quickly, the FAA did, according to the timeline, notify NORAD in a prompt way with that, and yet NORAD says the flights didn't take off until 8:52, and the South Tower was hit at 9:03, and yet if you do the math there, the flight still should have gotten there in time, given the speed at which they can go, and yet the official story is that they were 70 miles away when the South Tower was hit. But that story should feed right then into the story about the Pentagon, because according to the official account, it was at 8:46 that Flight 77 went off track, and then at 8:50 lost radio control, and then at 8:56 they tell us they saw it turn around on the radar and head back towards Washington at 8:56. So at 7 minutes later, these two fighters were presumably coming to New York. New York is very close to Washington at those speeds. Those jets should have been sent immediately to protect Washington, to protect the nation's capital. And yet they weren't. They were sent back home, again, according to the official story. And then no other jets were scrambled, although Andrews Air Base is just 10 miles from the Capitol. No airplanes were scrambled from there. Now, NORAD, again, according to the second version, maybe I should explain that, one of the smoking guns is the very fact that there were two versions. The first 3 days, the military was saying that they did not send up any planes until after the Pentagon was hit at 9:38. That would obviously be a gross violation of standard operating procedures, and maybe because that would have been so obvious, the story got changed, and they started saying, oh, yes, we did scramble airplanes, but they got there too late. So almost everything you read about is this second version, and we don't even know if there's any truth to it whatsoever. But again, taking the second version as if it were true, and playing it out, we see that NORAD ordered the planes to be scrambled not from Andrews, but from Langley, which was over 100 miles away. And that's supposed to explain why they didn't quite get there in time. Nevertheless, if, again, you do the math, you find out that even by their own timeline, there was plenty of time to get there. So if the planes really flew, and if they were as late as they said they were, the planes must have been going no more than 500 or 600 or 700 miles an hour rather than 1,850. So whatever part of the story you look at, it simply doesn't compute.
There's a chapter in your book called What Hit the Pentagon, and there is a reference to a number of photos that were taken right after the impact that are actually available for viewing on the internet, and anybody listening to this program can go to the website of TUC Radio and find a link in the newest programs section and sort of follow along looking at the photos of that were initially taken. The website for TUC Radio is www.tucradio.org,
And you can follow the conversation by looking at a photo, for instance, taken by Tom Horan of the Associated Press took a photo just after the fire trucks had arrived, but before the firemen had been deployed, so right after the impact. And in that photo, the West Wing's facade hadn't collapsed yet. And there are fire trucks to be seen in the photo, and there's a pretty pristine green lawn all the way up to the building without any scratches in it. And there isn't any sign of any airplane, no fuselage, no tail, no wings, no engines, nothing.
That's right. And in fact, there is a website called Hunt the Boeing, because when you see how small the hole was that was created by whatever hit the Pentagon, only the nose of a Boeing 757 would have gone inside. Therefore, the rest of it should have been out there on the lawn ready to be photographed, and yet there is no sign of it whatsoever. Now, to put this in context, let me back up. When I first was getting into this, I had learned about the first two flights, but then I heard about this Terry Masson, this French writer, who had argued that what hit the Pentagon was not a Boeing 757, but a missile. And I thought, well, that must be absurd, because if it were a missile, how could, I mean, the size of a missile is so different from that of a Boeing 757. How could they possibly have convinced the press and the American public and people in Washington that it was Flight 77? And still, many people today, when they hear that theory, they just use that as self-evidently absurd. But what people need to ask is, what evidence do they have that it was Flight 77 and that it therefore was a Boeing 757? And in actual fact, the only evidence for that theory is that the Pentagon says so. There is no physical evidence to support that. Now, many people say, oh, yes, we know because Barbara Olson called and said she was on Flight 77 and was headed towards the Pentagon. But in actual fact, we don't know that. First of all, Chad Olson did not say that she said, identified where the flight was, but only that she was on the flight and that hijackers had taken control of it. There's no mention about the idea that it's going to Washington. Secondly, all we know is that Ted Olson told us that. And, of course, he has been the chief attorney for the Bush administration, and he has also publicly, before the Supreme Court, defended the legitimacy of lying to the public. So at least one must take that with a grain of salt. So if we dismiss that, then one can see that there is no other evidence. And if you look at all the physical evidence, it supports another theory. As you mentioned, the hole that was created in the facade that was taken by another photograph was taken by a Marine, and it shows that the hole was no more than 18 feet in diameter. Now, we know that Boeing 757 has a wingspan of 125 feet about, and it's about 40 feet high. So at going at 400 miles an hour, it would have created a tremendous hole in the Pentagon. And indeed, that's evidently what the Pentagon put out, because the next day, September 12th, the Washington Post had a story in which it said the hole that was created was five stories high and 200 feet wide. And I checked with one of the authors of this and asked him where he got that information, and he said he didn't remember, but most plausibly he got it from the Pentagon itself. Now, that is about the size of a hole that the 757 would create, but unfortunately the physical evidence shows that's not what happened. And then, as you mentioned, there is other physical evidence There is other eyewitness testimony. The fire chief was asked the next day what remains of the Boeing he saw inside the Pentagon, because obviously it wasn't outside, so it had to have gone inside. And he said, well, I didn't see any big pieces, no fuselage, no engines, no wings. Now, a month later, his memory got refreshed, and he swore that he saw these things. He even said he saw some things that, according to the Pentagon, hadn't been found yet, like the black box. So we can be more certain, I think, of his immediate testimony than the testimony he gave a month later when he there'd been time to put some pressure on him. But there were other witnesses who also said they saw nothing. So there's all that evidence. And then from my point of view, the most decisive thing is the very fact that whatever it is that hit the Pentagon, hit the Pentagon. That is, had it been a commercial airliner, it would have been shot down automatically, because the Pentagon, probably the most defended place on the face of the earth, is lined with batteries of missiles. And they are set to shoot down anything that does not radiate a friendly signal from its transponder. The only thing that would radiate a friendly signal would be some sort of U.S. military aircraft. So that's what leads many of us to believe that whatever it was, and it's immaterial really whether it was a missile or a small military aircraft, the important thing is all the evidence suggests it was not only relatively small, but it must have been a military aircraft.
You heard part one of a two-part interview with David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. Professor Griffin has taught philosophy of religion at the Claremont School of Theology in Southern California for over 30 years. He is the author and editor of over 20 books. You can find more information on David Ray Griffin on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with David Ray Griffin by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.